Good morning. Please be seated. Today's oral argument calendar begins with the case of GMC Mortgage, LLC versus the Nevada Association Services, Inc. et al., case number 65260, an NRAP 5 case. Mr. Sassy, you ready to proceed?
Chief, may I make a disclosure?
Yes, of course.
Proceed? I just want to disclose, I'm a member of the Mortgage Community Association. Pay dues. I'm guessing there's 1,000 people or something in it, but I have one house in that community. I don't feel it will affect my ability to be fair and impartial to both sides.
Okay. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Justices, Anthony Sassy on behalf of GMAC Mortgage, LLC. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes. As this court is aware, this is a certified question from the U.S. Federal Court. That question is, what effect, if any, is there upon a foreclosure sale conducted pursuant to Nevada Revised Statute 116.31162 when the association refuses to provide the holder of a first security interest under a deed of trust secured by the unit with a specific amount due under the portion of the association's delinquent assessment lien has been made prior to the deed of trust by Nevada Revised Statute 116.31162, subsection 2. In its certified question, the United States District Court focused on the HOA and its agent's conduct and how it conducted and how its conduct affects the resulting foreclosure sale. The short answer to the U.S. District Court certified question is it renders the sale void and the sale should be set aside. Understanding that the HOA's refusal to provide the payoff information limits the beneficiary of the first deed of trust's ability to pay off the super priority piece of the lien, the U.S. District Court did not focus on the beneficiary's response, but rather on the conduct that limited the beneficiary's ability to respond. In analyzing the question, there are two parts. First, is the association and its agent obligated to provide the beneficiary of the first deed of trust with a super priority payoff amount? It is. In determining what requirements are set forth in the statute, the court must look at the statutory scheme as a whole with the purpose of the statute in mind. This court stated in SFR Investments versus U.S. Bank that the purpose of the statute and the split lien approach is to strike an equitable balance between the need to enforce the collection of unpaid assessments and the obvious necessity for protecting the priority of the security interests of the lenders. To strike this balance, the court stated that beneficiaries of the first deed of trust can pay off that amount. In order to effectuate that, the beneficiaries of the first deed of trust must be given that amount. While the statute does not provide any explicit requirement that the amount be given by the HOA or its agent, the obligation is inherent looking at the scheme as a whole. If HOAs are not required to provide that payoff, it undermines the purpose of the statute. If given the control to determine what amounts the beneficiary of the first deed of trust is able to pay, the HOA and its agent effectively decides whether or not the super priority piece gets satisfied or whether the entirety of the lien will be satisfied. If given that choice, the HOA and its agent will never, or likely never, accept a super priority payoff amount.
You're basically indicating that it's a good faith argument.
There are two parts to the argument. First, that there is an inherent requirement within the statute, but to the extent that the court would find that there isn't a requirement, the good faith obligation found in 116.1113 provides a gap filling, a requirement of good faith in all acts the association conducts. Specific to a request from a beneficiary or a first deed of trust as to whether to provide the payoff information, the good faith requirement would fill that gap to say that conducting a sale in good faith would require providing payoff information to junior lien holders.
Do you have a preference in terms of the analytics if you were to draft an opinion along the lines of what you're advocating for? Do you prefer an analysis that says this requirement of being responsive to a demand for the payoff amount is inherent in the statutory scheme, or that it is a product of the good faith requirement that's expressly articulated in it? And why do you prefer one or the other?
I believe the legislature has answered that question for us. In the recent amendments to NRS 116-3116 through SB 306, there are a number of statutory amendments that now specifically require clarifying what the statute has always said, that the payoff of the super priority amount must be provided. Now, in the notice of default that the association must record, they're specifically required to identify that amount.
So you prefer, I sense from your answer, you mean that it was implicit but unspoken in the statute, now it's articulated.
Correct.
So you would do it as an implicit requirement rather than under the umbrella of good faith?
In answering the question of which to prefer, I don't know that I prefer one, but I believe because of the legislature's action that the more appropriate response would to say that it was inherent prior to the statutory amendments, and that through the statutory amendments, they made clear what has always been in the statute.
Fair enough.
So inherent, implied, or ambiguous? And in the case of ambiguous, then what?
Then we would look to the statutory scheme as a whole to read it in harmony, to effectuate the purpose of the entirety of the statute. So in any ambiguity, we would look beyond to the fact that the beneficiary of the first deed of trust has the option to pay off the super priority amount. That's what the SFR decision made clear. And so in order to effectuate that ability, there would have to be a gap filler in the language. And in addition to that would be the requirement of good faith found in NRS 116-1113.
Mr. Sasse, is there anything in the legislature's 2015 legislative history that suggests that it was intending to clarify this omission in the prior act, or is that simply your conclusion that they were clarifying this when they enacted this change? I'm not sure that I've seen that in the legislative history, so I wondered what your cite for that was.
I have no specific reference to legislative history. It would be based off of the legislature's response to this court's ruling in SFR, as well as the ways that the amendments.
You would agree with me that there's nothing in the legislative history in the 2015 legislature that this court could examine that would support the contention that they were trying to clarify this earlier omission.
I am not aware of any in the legislative history, Your Honor.
So, to the point that it's implied in the statute, what statutory provision do you point us to that suggests that it is implied? Which of all these statutes in 116 about notices and the like, which provision indicates that they have this duty?
Well,
the HOA has this duty. I'm sorry.
The requirement would be in 116-3116-2 and the sequence through 116-3116-8, the notice requirements in terms of providing notice to junior lien holders and providing notice to interested parties of what would be required in order to protect their interest. When the statute was originally drafted, there was no language specifying that the super priority payoff amount would need to be provided, but there is in the statutory scheme a requirement that junior lien holders be notified and be notified of what is required of them to stop the sale and protect their interest.
You've reserved some time. To me, the more important question in this certified question, just speaking for myself, is the remedy. You suggest that the sale should be set aside. Why? Shouldn't perhaps the association have to bear the responsibility of choosing not to provide this information under a good faith argument?
Your Honor, this court has stated on a number of occasions that foreclosure sales that are a result of fraud, oppression, or unfairness are ripe to be set aside. The type of conduct that rises to the level of oppression or unfairness is the type of conduct that prejudices a junior lien holder.
But doesn't Chapter 116 protect a bona fide purchaser by declaration, saying that the deed that's issued is a recognition that all formalities were properly addressed?
No.
And if that statement is wrong, who bears the responsibility for that statement?
There is no statement in 1163, Chapter 116, in particular the recitals and the conclusive presumptions that they give, that it is as to a bona fide purchaser. It says it's to all persons. However, the conclusions and presumptive conclusions are limited. The presumptive conclusions that are included in the statute specifically are limited to that there was a default, that there was a mailing of the notice of delinquent assessment lien, that the notice of default was recorded, notably not that the notice of default was mailed to interested parties, but only that the notice of default was recorded, and finally that there was a lapsing of 90 days between the notice of default and the notice of sale, and that the notice of sale was given.
Mm-hmm.
There's no statutory presumptive conclusion that the sale was conducted in good faith or that all notice requirements were satisfied. Only the specific recitals that are identified in the statute are conclusively presumed.
So
you're looking at 31166 for that and reading it narrowly to its express terms?
Yes, Your Honor.
You wanted to reserve
questions.
Time.
I would like to reserve the remainder of my questions.
Just one quick question. I understand your response, Justice Hardesty, but what about a third-party purchaser? If we're dealing with equity here and they go in and bid and they bid in good faith, they're not involved with an obligation to provide the payoff information, is it fair to them to set the sale aside?
The question goes to whether or not that party would be a bona fide purchaser. The question is whether the purchaser would have knowledge or a reasonable belief in a senior claim on title to the property. In fact, NRS 111.1180 requires that the purchaser, in order to qualify for bona fide purchaser protection, does not have actual knowledge, constructive knowledge, or a reasonable cause to know that there exists a defect in or adverse right, title, or interest to the real property. I would submit that purchasing a property at an HOA foreclosure sale where there is no announcement as to the title being sold, to whether or not the super priority amount has been paid, that no purchaser could know conclusively the nature of the title that they're purchasing. So by the action of a HOA sale, without any indication as to what was being purchased, that they could not claim bona fide purchaser protection.
Thank you very much.
But how
So you're suggesting that anyone who goes to an HOA foreclosure sale can't be a bona fide purchaser because it's an HOA sale?
Because as the statute was written at the time, there was no requirement that the auctioneer announce whether or not a super priority piece payment had been made. So there would be no way for a purchaser at the sale to know the nature of the title it was buying. Was it buying a sale based on the sub-priority piece, thus buying it subject to the first deed of trust? Or was it buying a sale based off of the senior the super-priority piece, which would potentially extinguish a first deed of trust?
So we are still talking about good faith, so do you have any case law that supports this position you are taking?
Position that not knowing the nature of the title. In the Born Dowley versus Wells Fargo, the federal court examined this and stated that buyers of...
As to good faith, though.
Not as to good faith. As to the good faith argument that there's a requirement to provide the super priority payoff amount.
But I'd like to go back to this point. It seems to me you broadly answered Justice Gibbons' question, but the certified question in front of us is whether or not, if this court finds that the homeowners association's failure to respond to the super priority amount of Bridges good faith, that would be a new ruling in this state. But more importantly, how would a purchaser ever know that the one conducting the sale has a Bridge good faith? Why shouldn't that result in a damage claim by your client against the homeowners association rather than setting aside the sale?
There is case law, Your Honor, Nevada Land and Mortgage versus Hidden Wells Ranch, I believe, is the citation. I don't have the specific reporter citation. It talks about not only fraud, oppression, or unfairness, but irregularities in the sale. As to whether or not that those irregularities would undermine standing to claim bona fide purchaser protection, I would also argue that buying a property at a foreclosure sale inherently provides notice that there may be a senior claim, including from the homeowner or other encumbrancers who potentially are having their liens extinguished.
Well, I could see that irregularity argument if there's a credit bid by the HOA. We'll get into that in the next case, but I'm not so sure it applies where you're dealing with a third party who walks in and buys it up. Thank you for your comments. We'll add 2 minutes to your time, so you have 2.5 minutes for your rebuttal.
Thank you.
Ms. Gilbert, you're going to start?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices, may it please the Court, Jacqueline Gilbert and Diana Klein-Ebron on behalf of Keynote Properties, LLC. Mr. Peter Dunkley and Kate Anderson are here on behalf of the Association and on Nevada Association Services, and we will be splitting our time. Keynote was a successful bidder, the third-party purchaser at the HOA sale, at the publicly noticed, publicly held foreclosure auction. And the answer to the certified question should be a resounding no effect.
Let me ask you this. Why in the world, if you've got a mortgagor that's looking for a payoff, wouldn't you give it to him? Your interest as an HOA is to get your super priority amount back, right? And the amount of the assessments.
Justice Perry, I believe that is the association's.
Right.
And I, again, am the third-party purchaser at the sale.
I
believe that the argument that you are going to hear is that there is a problem with federal law that is without express consent from the borrower, their borrower, who is also the prior homeowner, to discuss the debt that under FDCPA, that they may not be able to do that. I believe that you'll hear that argument in full from the Homeowners Association. Again, I'm representing the party who showed up at the sale and had nothing to do with anything that happened prior to the day of the sale.
And then, Ms. Gilbert, can you respond to the position taken by GMC as to obligation or the good faith purchaser? Is there, in fact, the ability to be a good faith purchaser?
Yes, I believe there can, Your Honor. What when you have, for non-judicial foreclosure sale process to work, there have to be some protections for the purchaser. One of those is the conclusive recital that noticing was properly done, there was a default, they had the right to go forward with the sale. The second is the title is indefeasible. It is without warranty, without equity, or right of redemption. It's the same.
The counsel gave us a very narrow reading of those presumptions, making it possible to, for lack of a better word, deal with the irregularities, so to speak, that are outside of those specific enunciated presumptions.
And I understand that, Your Honor. And what basically counsel Mr. Sassy was arguing was that the onus would be on someone to find out what might have happened in the past versus
If you look at 116-31166, he has a fair point that the statute's establishing a conclusive presumption, but it is limited by its terms to default, mailing of notice, recording of the notice of default, election of sale, elapsing of 90 days. It doesn't say compliance with the duty of good faith and fair dealing and tendering the amount due in order to buy out the super priority piece of the lien. That's not articulated in that statute. So for you to get to the point you're at, I'm worried about the statute.
And I understand your concern, Justice Pickering. The issue is that can you still be a BFP? And I think that was the question, is can you still be a BFP
Even if
so,
that's narrow.
So you concede that this conclusive presumption statute does not help you establish yourself as a BFP with respect to this issue?
Well, I don't, because part of the conclusive presumptions is that the noticing requirements of law were abided by. And if the noticing requirements by law include the good faith requirement, then I think it would
cover. Well, is that your position or isn't it? Because
that would be my position, Your Honor.
Okay.
In addition, under 107, remember that these requirements, the conclusive proof requirement and most of the noticing requirements came from 107 at the time they were adopted. In 2007, there was an addition to 107 that included that there is no BFP under a 107 sale, probably for the same reasons you're looking at right now, is that you're buying and there is the possibility of senior liens without warranty. But you also get an indefeasible title, remember, without equity or right of redemption. In 2009, they removed that language. The banks removed that language from the statute. They asked for it to be removed. So it got put in, there's no BFP, it got taken out. So I don't think you can read in that there is no BFP. I don't think that you can even look at that. It wasn't there in 1991. It was put in and removed again.
Ms. Gilbert, can a third-party purchaser like your client obtain title insurance in this state to ensure their purchase of property at an HOA sale?
At this moment in time, Your Honor, no.
Okay.
And primarily we have to look at, you have primarily two, it's the title insurance and it's actually the people behind who give the money and do the insurance that are very risk averse. And obviously we've been having litigation for 3 or 4 years now on this, so they are very risk averse and they're not going to go there yet. But what I would like to say is you have to look at the whole cast of characters, and I think Justice Gibbons, Justice Hardesty brought this up, is you have cast of characters that includes the purchaser who has nothing to do with what happened before.
But, you know, when you've got an HOA sale, because there's delinquent assessments, does that make it suspect to any purchaser that comes along later? And especially in this case where they're requesting from the Homeowners Association a payoff and they can't get it, to me it just smacks of terrible unfairness and bona fide for purchasers in these HOA sales may have constructive knowledge that there's a defect in the what they're purchasing.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think that that's a very wide reading, and I think that if you have to protect the nonjudicial foreclosure process, and that protects the purchaser, and I don't want to go too far over, but
has a remedy here, too. Before the sale, all they got to do is file suit if they're not getting a response to their request and enjoin the sale.
Exactly, Your Honor. What I was going to say is you want to put a constructive notice on the purchaser rather than put a duty on the person who's saying they can't get their remedy to not notify the world by filing suit, getting the court to intervene, and putting Liz Pendens on the property, which would take care of the entire issue, rather than putting it on the person who shows up at a sale without any knowledge to the world, which they had a very easy means to do. I would like to leave the reason for not giving the issue.
Is there any allegation in the complaint at issue in the federal district court case that suggests or even contends that your client knew that the bank was seeking this information and it was not being provided?
None, Your Honor.
Okay. All right, Mr. Dunkley.
Thank you. May it please the Court, Peter Dunkley for Cocoli Ranch Community Association and Nevada Association Services Incorporated. I'll anticipate your question, Justice Perry-Gary. The reason why NAS did not respond is because of the FDCPA. The FDCPA, the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, broadly written to prohibit communications with third parties about a debt. And the debt, in this case, is the HOA's assessment lien. And so when Nevada Association Services receives a request, universally the response is, if you obtain the homeowner's consent, we can provide that information to you and discuss.
So in each and every instance, you would prefer to be sued and incur attorney's fees and costs and any other related fees and have a list penance put on the property as opposed to disclosing an amount that was due?
Well, I think what we would look at is whose burden it is to do that. The lender goes into this transaction with its eyes wide open. It evaluates the creditworthiness of the borrower. It evaluates the suitability of the property. It evaluates the CC&Rs. It makes this transaction with full knowledge of the effects of an assessment lien. And so when it comes, and a lender is well-versed in the FDCPA liability. In fact, to answer your earlier question to Mr. Sassy earlier was, my client, NAS, participated in the lobbying for the revisions to NRS 116. And it's his opinion that the revisions, which now require the parsing of the lien, are a result of the bank's lobbying in no small portion because of the FDCPA prohibition to discuss debt. So when a third party comes in and asks NAS for information, that third party's obligation is simple. Go talk to the person that you went into a deal with and get their consent.
Mr. What happens, though, and I'm sure it's happened in many cases, the homeowner is gone. You know, they're in default on their mortgage, they're in default on their HOA dues, they've taken off, or they're non-responsive. I mean, isn't that basically impossible sometimes for the bank to even get permission from them to disclose this?
In that instance, if it were impossible, Chief Justice Hartz, you noted that the lender can run to court. And in these facts, in this case, the lender had almost 2 years to do that. The first notice was recorded in 2011. The foreclosure occurred in 2013. All these remedies are set forth in the deed of trust of the statute.
I'm struggling with the reliance on the FDCPA. The statute requires that you identify the amount owed by the homeowner in the notice of sale. Where in the FDCPA, what provision are you relying upon that prohibits the HOA from allocating the amount that is owed in the notice of sale between the super priority lien and the sub priority lien?
So the section is 15 U.S.C. 1692C, subparagraph B, and that covers communications with third parties. And it's broadly written and broadly construed communications, and banks and collection companies such as NAS make business decisions as to whether or not they can communicate with third parties.
So at least with respect to the bank's argument that the association did not participate in this matter in good faith, you would argue we did our best.
I would argue that the bank's good faith obligation would be to at least contact their borrower and try to.
Well, we're focused on your good faith behavior, and you're suggesting that we acted in good faith because we were prohibited from disclosing the super priority amount under the FDCPA. Did you say that in a letter? Did your client say that in a letter, in a phone call? Is there any affidavit that supports the suggestion that you referred the bank to the FDCPA and to the homeowner themselves?
While preparing for argument, my client has represented if a communication did in fact occur, then that's the response. That's the same response you'd get if you called them today rather than at the time of the foreclosure. The problem with this case, that the hypothetical certified question doesn't reflect the facts of this case. The only communications that took place in this case, there are no record of that. There are two paragraphs in the complaint that says that the lender tried to contact the HOA and was rebuffed. My client has no record of that. There is no record provided by the lender as well. And so what we're dealing with is really the hypothetical situation where, let's just say,
from counsel, hypothetically, if your client had been called, would they have responded as you are, that they are prohibited because of the U.S. codes, or would they have just said, we can't do this?
NAS would have said, we are prohibited by the FDCPA. If they call the HOA directly, once a property is referred to collections, all those communications go to collections. So the HOA most likely a community manager would say, hey, you need to contact.
Well, in setting up the certified question, did you ask the federal district court to include that as a finding of fact on which this court would rely under Volvo to answer the question?
So I did not, Your Honor. The court redrafted the proposed certified question, and so this is the certified question that neither the bank nor the HOA nor the foreclosure purchaser participated in drafting.
So if we answer that second question in the affirmative,
and just to be clear, Your Honor,
you have an obligation to disclose or to provide that amount, then what?
Then we would provide the amount provided.
Notwithstanding what you claim is the prohibition on you doing it currently?
And I guess I'm not understanding the question. So
if we answer the question in the affirmative that you have to provide it, and you have here today been relying upon the federal code to say that you can't do that, my question is very, I hope, simple.
Sure.
Then what? Federal statute still is what it is.
I would have to defer to the business judgment of NASA's management or the HOA's management.
Did you raise that federal statute at any time in the federal court proceeding leading up to the certification of this question to this court?
I apologize, I don't know. I know it was in our opening brief, our responding brief.
In this court, I understand that,
yes.
But did you raise it in the federal district court?
I would have to review.
Because this is really, you're trying to argue preemption.
My apologies.
Well, it kind of leaves us in a tough spot. First of all, one of the concerns I have is if you're making this argument for the first time up here, it causes me to question if a letter was sent indicating, well, this would be a violation of FDCPA, if we were to give you that information, wouldn't that prompt the mortgagor then to perhaps file suit?
Well, that's exactly the point. In the hypothetical where an HOA has a blanket prohibition of contacting and they say, here's the owner's consent and we're not going to give it to you anyway, the lender still has four remedies. It can pay the lien, and anything it pays, that's the remedy set forth in the deed of trust. It gets added to the debt, and it ensures that the lender is protected and can pursue the borrower for the person who promised to pay the assessments in the first place. The second thing the lender can do is it can run to court. And as I said, on this record and these facts, the lender had 2 years, or almost nearly 2 years, to do that. Looking back retrospectively, as this case does, the lender could have established an escrow in advance at the time of its transaction. Of course, you obtain the consent. And so even in hypothetical, but
let me ask you something, Mr. Dunkley. This court has spent a lot of time preparing for this issue. You all have generated a lot of time writing briefs and the like. Do you think this court should rewrite the certified question under Volvo? We have done that on occasion. Would you advocate the court rewrite the certified question?
I think I would, and I think it's because the certified question, as it's drafted now, is completely hypothetical and does not necessarily apply to the facts of this case.
So we shouldn't have taken it in the first place.
It's of great concern because what you're saying today, I would almost surmise if the federal court had heard this argument, we probably wouldn't have this.
Right. Well, what I will say is that I think everyone in the room would appreciate the court's guidance on the question before the court.
Kind of advisory at this point, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and I would hesitate to tell the federal court what they
should be doing
under federal law. Yeah, it's of concern to me. They didn't have a chance to weigh in, at least if I understand the argument correctly.
Well, what was the process that developed this certified question? It's unusual that the federal judges don't request input on the certified question. I understood from the presentation here that both parties were requested to submit a certified question, and then the court took it from there.
That's exactly what happened, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. When the court sent its order to this court, it had redrafted the question.
So I again asked the question, if this court were to rewrite this question addressing the applicability of the FDCPA, you would urge this court to do so?
That would be a more narrow question, but and as I stated in my briefs, there are multiple reasons beyond the FDCPA why the question before the court right now, despite the HOA's conduct, the lender has a complete universe of remedies, multiple remedies that are independent and could not be blocked by an HOA, despite even if there were bad faith, which there is not. But the HOA, between its deed of trust and all the remedies provided in NRS 116, provides
but NRAP 5 that deals with dispositive issues of state law, not dispositive issues of federal law. The federal courts don't send federal questions to our court to opine on preemption under federal law. I get we could say, well, we've got to construe the statute consistent with federal law, thereby avoiding a supremacy clause problem, but I'm a little concerned about this, candidly, whether this was improvidently accepted.
I do have one more question. My understanding, as was indicated, is that you each submitted questions that you wanted answered and certified to the court. And it doesn't sound like they were the same questions that were submitted to the court if the court rewrote the question that we were to certify. What was your question you submitted to the court to be certified?
I would need to look at the brief, Your Honor. It was some time ago. I apologize.
Okay. Are there any other questions for Mr. Dunkley? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Dunkley. Mr. Sassy?
Mr. Sassy, I guess that kind of leads into a question I have based on what the opposing counsel said. Why didn't the bank and your client, in this case, go in and ask for a temporary restraining order and all against the sale so you could use that mechanism to block it pending getting this information you needed on the super priority?
Your Honor, I candidly cannot speak to GMAC's mindset at the time prior to the foreclosure sale. Those facts aren't in the record as we sit here. In reviewing the certified question, though, we have to remember that this is a question to answer a question of law and how that action affects the resulting foreclosure sale. In the interim, there may be any number of reasons why any particular beneficiary may or may not elect to initiate litigation between the HOA's refusal to provide the payoff and the foreclosure sale. Answering the question as to whether the FDCPA applies and creates a safeguard, it does not for a number of reasons. First, the FDCPA is a prohibition on debt collectors communicating with third parties. The HOA is not a debt collector. A debt collector is collecting the debt of another. So there's no prohibition on the HOA communicating with a beneficiary of a first deed of trust to provide any payoff information. Second, the FDCPA only prohibits communications with third parties in attempts to collect the debt. As we laid out in our briefs, a foreclosure sale is distinguishable from an attempt to collect the debt, an attempt to collect the debt, and an attempt to collect money from the borrower. In this action, it would be an attempt to collect on the property itself, which would not be the same, and FDCPA would not apply.
Has this been raised? Was this raised in the federal court proceedings thus far?
It was not raised in the federal court proceedings. At the time of the briefing, there was a motion to dismiss the counterclaims of Keynote Properties, and in response to that motion to dismiss, which was predicated pre-SFR on the HOA sale having no effect on a first deed of trust, the request for a certified question was raised. I do not believe that the HOA or NAS raised any defenses.
Along the issue of remedy, let's assume for the moment that Mr. Dunkley is correct that the Fair Debt Collection Act does apply, an issue that is at the moment unresolved. It really does raise a separate question about the bona fide purchaser. How in the world would a bona fide purchaser ever know whether the Fair Debt Collection Act has been complied with in any HOA sale? My goodness. how deeply are we expecting bona fide purchasers to look at these sales before they go in and bid? It's a rhetorical question, but...
I understand, Your Honor. If I could just finish my thought on why the FDCPA does not apply. The third point would be the payoff information necessary to give the super priority portion is not the borrower's debt. As this court has articulated, it's 9 months of assessments. That amount is not the borrower's debt. That is information available to the HOA and available to the collection company to provide...
What do you mean it's not the borrower's debt?
The monthly assessment is not unique to the borrower. So if for instance, Pecoli Ranch charges X amount of dollars per month, providing that information is not providing information unique to the borrower's debt. That is general information regarding the association and the dues it charges.
That doesn't make sense to me. Well, this is a unique, I think what it does is underscores the fact that maybe there's a federal statute out here that needs to be interpreted. Are there any questions?
I have a follow-up question. Let's say we agree with your reading and your reply brief on this federal statute. Can we even really, in fairness, reach that, given the NRAP 5 mechanism? There is a limit. We're not the Attorney General to whom you can write a letter saying, would you please give us an opinion letter on this fact? I mean, that is not the province of this court. And so I'm a bit concerned that even if we were inclined to agree with you that this is not a debt collector and this is the Pecoli Ranch trying to collect its own debt, so it's engaged in a lien foreclosure process, it's outside the fair, whatever the anagram stands for federally on that act. But even if we wanted to agree with you and therefore reach the issue head on, can we do that consistent with NRAP 5 and our jurisdictional limitations in this context?
I believe you can because, as I said, I don't believe the FDCPA applies to this particular instance, that it would be a defense that they've raised as to why they haven't provided it. But the court can interpret the statute as to whether the statute itself requires it.
Well, there is another alternative. We can ask the U.S. District Court to address this question and reserve our ruling till they do. Thank you, Mr. Stussy. The matter will stand submitted. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments today.